Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Short Coat Podcast. I'm Dave Ettler, and we're here today to mark a momentous occasion. On Monday of this week, the lives of over 50,000 people settled into a new shape. And as we record this less than, 2 hours ago? 3 hours ago? Maybe 26,000 of those people found out what they would be doing for work for the rest of their lives, maybe. These people of which I speak, fourth-year medical students from all around the world, finally found out after so many years of hard work, not only where they'd be going to complete their medical training, but whether they would be allowed to complete it.
Ooh. Dramatic.
The National Resident Matching Program, or NRMP, was established in 1952. It's a nonprofit organization whose mission is to take the rank-ordered choices of residency applicants and residency program directors and create optimum matches between the two. I'm joined today by Damian Ehrig, our registrar here at the CCOM.
Hello.
And an expert on all things match. Right?
Yes.
Anyway, and I'm also joined by Jordan Harbaugh Williams and Nathan Miller.
Hello.
Both of whom are distant from the match at this point.
Not experts by any means.
As both of you are first years, right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, Jordan and Nathan, did I just scare the heck out of you with that? With those figures? Did that put a little fear into you? Because there's more to it than that. I pulled out the big, broad figures, but I have a feeling that Damian will break it down for us.
Yeah, it's actually not as bad as it sounds, which is good news.
I guess you did say optimum matches, so that made me happy that they're not just like matching you randomly, but I don't know. I feel like all the other stuff surrounding it was really scary.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't know what's going on.
I only used those figures because I knew that it would be, you know, dramatic podcasting right there.
It sure was.
You know what I'm saying? I created an atmosphere of scary horror, but Damian can tell us. And hey, we're also joined by Melissa Palma. Melissa, pull down your microphone there. Just, you know what to do. You've done this before. Oh, and let me turn up your mic there. How's that?
Hello.
Hey, there she is.
Wonderful.
We're also joined by Melissa Palma, who just went through this whole process.
Exciting.
Right?
I did.
Successfully,
I might add.
Awesome. So, Damian, tell us more. Can you break it down for us? Maybe give us some sort of overall statistics about the match.
Sure. Yeah. So, the good news for all of us sitting here is that the match is actually heavily weighted in favor of the allopathic medical graduate, which, of course, all of you will soon be, or in a few years. So about 94% is fairly steady, is the match rate from year to year. So 94% of the graduating seniors who go into this end up finding a position. And in the minds of the NRMP, they consider a match if you've got at least a first-year position. So if you've got at least 1 year of graduate training after medical school, they consider that a match. But of course, most training programs go longer than that. So there are some things you can read into those stats. But good news is 94%, pretty much a steady stat from year to year, students will end up finding a position in the match.
And those are national when you say 94%.
Yeah, that's national. Yep.
Okay. I found an article about the match algorithm, the thing that everybody... Mm-hmm. That everybody always thinks about. Did you hear much about the match algorithm?
I have seen the match algorithm in various articles. Apparently, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's based on, is it called the stable marriage problem or the state, is an algorithm in
computer
science.
It's a computer science thing, yeah.
And so whenever I meet someone in computer science, I always bring up the match, and then I say the word stable marriage problem, and then their eyes light up, and they immediately connect to what I'm trying to explain.
Yeah.
Because in order to explain to someone who's not in medicine, or to explain the match process is kind of an arduous task, but if you meet someone in computer science and you can say the words stable marriage problem, they know exactly what you're talking about.
Did they steal this from like OkCupid or match.com or something?
Yes.
Is that where the name comes
from? So this is
this algorithm, basically the idea is how to find stable pairings, or the problem is how to find a stable pairing between two sets of people. And in the problem, it's husbands and wives. Okay, so stable means no one has a greater preference for someone other than their match. So that's the sort of the definition of stable here. Hmm. David Gale and Lloyd Shapley, 1962, they were the people who sort of came up with the algorithm. And Shapley and a guy named Alvin Roth, who did more work on it, they got the Nobel Prize for it in 2012. So it's kind of a big...
Wow.
It's kind of a big deal. Hmm. Do you know much more about that? Should I continue with my research, Damien? Do you know much more about the stable marriage?
No.
Problem? All right. Well, that makes me the smartest man. So there are two forms. There's hospital optimal and there's student optimal. And by optimal, it means that, you know, for in the student optimal case, no student can improve his or her match by submitting a rank list that is different from his or her true preferences. So... You can't game the system, I guess, is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you could probably hurt your chances.
Our advice from year to year is rank the programs in your order of preference. Don't try and overthink it.
It's pretty simple.
Number one is number one. Number two is number two. Yeah. Just go down the list.
But there's always people, I think, who are tempted to...
You see, the thing is, in medical school, you know, they teach you to have critical thinking skills, right? And so we always want to read between the lines and try to, you know, come up with the most, with either the most creative or, to us, the most logical ideas of where things should go on our list. So sometimes, you know, you can play mind games with yourself about where you should rank places just based on, you know, the excellent clinical reasoning skills that we learn here at the Carver College of Medicine.
So what would
basically we've made you think you're smarter than everybody else.
What's the most tempting way for people to try to game the system, or what would be an example of that?
Well, it's just like Melissa just said, it's overthinking it. So, trying to think, I think I'm more likely, you know, to get this spot, but it's not necessarily my number one, so where should I put that?
And it's also
on my list?
It's also kind of a psychological game, because, you know, trying to choose a residency program and having residency programs choose you, it's like you're all dating each other for 4 months at a time. You know, you go out on these dinners and you talk about yourselves and your values and how you feel like you could grow as people and residents and physicians for the next 3 to 4 to 5 to 7 years, depending on what kind of program you apply to. And then you send back correspondences that say whether or not to state your level of interest. But at the end of the day, it's out of your hands.
Mm-hmm. What are the rules, Damien, as far as like during the interview process, what are the rules that the programs and the applicants have to follow? Like, I understand there's a rule like you're not supposed to say, well, I love you the most kind of.
Well, one would hope that everybody just ethically is on the same page and programs aren't saying, you know, you're my number one. And then the next student comes in and you're my number one. Obviously, we try and, you know, guard students against that. You know, there may be some, grayer statements that are used, like, we thought you were great and we're going to rank you highly. What is highly? Is highly, you know, number one, number 10? Where does that work? So, that's where some of the, some of the worry or, crossed wires can come from. You don't really know where you stand with that particular program necessarily after you've been there. You may have fallen in love with it, but maybe the student is hesitant to say something to the program, and then the program again, you don't know how to read what they've told you, and so it just it adds into that mix of not knowing exactly what programs are looking for, and then not knowing where you stand, and that's where a lot of anxiety comes from. But I think Melissa can probably comment more on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like throughout the entire interview and match process, I kind of, I'm a neurotic medical student, so I kept a very organized, detailed list of everything I thought about every single program and all the people I interacted with. And along the way, I would, have a rolling list already constructing even as I was interviewing through programs. But then I kind of put it away. I put it, out of my mind for a couple of months until closer to, the end of February when you do need to make your rank list. I kind of took out the list again and thought about, after having time to process, you know, the different people who I had met, talking with my classmates who are also applying, I'm going into family medicine, and many of us were interested in very similar types of programs, and we had all interviewed at different programs and kind of bouncing ideas back and forth. Oh, is that really what I thought of that program? Was that one day I spent with them, is that representative of what their the entire, you know, 3 years of my life will be?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I came back to it, but at the end, after the whole process, and I remade my list, taking in all of those other information I had, and at the end, the day before I submitted, you know, I knew that's exactly how I wanted my list to be.
Because you felt pretty confident about your list.
I felt pretty confident after, you know, thinking about it for about 4 months. So, so I mean, the moral of the story is start early. Don't think you're going to sit down in the third week of February on a Monday night and say, okay, I'm going to decide everything right now.
Yeah, that would be basically my plan. but yeah.
That's a lot to think about.
Yeah. I hope you guys already are. I was intrigued to note that this year, a medical student and software developer named Vishnu Ravi did an experiment. He used a version of the algorithm adapted from one by a guy named Rob W. Irving. He's a computer science researcher specializing in algorithms at the University of Glasgow. The NRMP, by the way, doesn't publish the code.
Correct.
That they use to do the match. He used an Amazon cloud server with sort of middling specs, you know, nothing fancy. He ran it 100 times using a data set that he says closely resembled the 2014 main resident match information. So information from last year. Any guesses on how long it took to run the algorithm?
17 seconds.
Yes, you read the article.
I read that article.
17 seconds.
Every medical student in the country probably read that article who was a fourth year.
Absolutely. What does that suggest to you guys?
It suggests to me that computers have come a long way since the match first started. And just out of tradition, they decide, no, we'll just make them wait.
I hadn't actually thought of that one. Because my first reaction was, 17 seconds? That's so lame for all this lead up to it. I mean, it's a complicated problem, but, you know, 17 seconds, that's
amazing. I think it's the optimization piece that probably takes more time. I think it's iterative, so I'm not sure they run it once. They may tweak it and then run it again, but I'm not certain about that.
Yeah. Well, they don't. It's you know. They used to do it, up until 1997, they used to do it hospital optimal, is what this article by Mr. Ravi. I'm assuming it's a mister. Do you think? Vishnu? I have no idea.
I think so. I'm just inserting a picture into my head of what a Mr. Ravi would look like.
I'm going to say it's just Vishnu. Vishnu tells us that they used the hospital optimal form up until 1997. And then I guess enough students complained about it that they switched to the student optimal form. But the differences between the two are very minor. So you guys were the squeaky wheel.
But I feel like it's always, you know, peace of mind.
Yeah.
Because at first you have to come to accept that your fate is in the hands of a Nobel Prize winning computer algorithm who is very impartial.
What better person to have your fate in the hands of?
You know, medical students very much are the kind
of... Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. In my life, I have never had my fate has never been in the hands of some Nobel Prize winner. Not even once. It's weird.
But I feel like we always like to feel like we have some control. And when you know, completely relinquish that control to an entity which you do not know, there's always, you know, some kind of, you know, solace or relief in the fact that at least my preferences take precedent in some minor way, no matter how insignificant that is. That I feel like at the end of the day, that's what gives you, you know, comfort in the fact that, you know, we're going through this crazy process with 20,000 other people. Anything can happen, but at least, you know, if I were true to how I really wanted my list to be, then I'll end up where I need to end up.
I think that's probably where the drive to game the system comes in, because you're like, I need to have some control over this. I need to, you know, I can maybe put this program ahead of that one, and I'll get that one instead. I don't know how it works exactly.
Yeah, that's got to be actually a big drive.
Trying to exert a tiny bit of control over the process.
Did you, among your BFFs, did you feel like everybody got what they wanted?
I feel like most people were very happy with what they wanted. Obviously, you know, there are going to be people who you know, for reasons that are not under their control, we're having less optimal outcomes. But for the most part, you know, everyone's really happy. Everyone's so supportive of each other. I mean, we've gone through 4 whole years of medical school together. And we're going to be lifelong friends and lifelong colleagues no matter where we end up.
What about couples matching? How does that work exactly?
Well,
Couples matching is when two people...
Yeah, you start with a couple.
Have a baby.
That's where you start. You start with a couple. And then that couple has to decide, are they going to throw themselves into the match as a unit, or are they going to go their separate ways in the match and hope for the best? And the folks who go the couples match route actually they're just slightly less successful in the match than the general uncoupled folks.
Successful meaning getting their optimum, they really want.
So I think it's, you know, around 93%+ of couples end up matching. So
I see.
So it's very close to the main match results, which again is right around 94%. It's a fairly stable number from year to year. And going back to Melissa's point, it actually turns out that about 80% of all the students end up getting one of their top 3 choices. So you have a very good chance of getting one of your top 3 choices. However, we also, during the advising process, we try and caution our students and make sure that they make their list long enough. It's a balance. You have to make sure your list is long enough so that you've got a good chance of matching, but at the same time, we tell you don't put anything on there that you would be very unhappy if you saw that on match day.
You know, I spoke to at least one person this year who had this odd strategy of, I don't know if it was a strategy, but this person basically confessed that, you know, they didn't like any of the things that they ranked.
They ranked only places they disliked.
I don't know. Like they didn't seem thrilled
seems
about
it. Seems like a losing strategy.
That is, yeah.
They didn't.
You're guaranteed to get a place you're not happy with. That way.
I don't know if this person is just being hyperbolic or.
Yeah. You might have misheard something. Maybe. I'm not sure.
It does seem like not a great.
So how do you, when you're ranking, how do you balance like really competitive programs with ones that you think you'd do, you know, like ones you like, but you'd rather be at a different one? Do you, I mean, I don't know how to word that exactly.
I guess the answer is when you're applying places, that's when you take into account the mix. Because when you're applying places, you don't know if you're going to get an interview. So, you know, you mix places that are maybe like reach schools or safety schools or schools that you know you'll probably get an interview at. But then once it comes down to the rank list, you don't take into account competitiveness. You take into account how much you want to go to that program.
Okay. Yeah, because what I've heard is that, you know, these so-called competitive schools may or may not be a great environmental fit. Right. In fact, some of them, you know, I don't know. I hope
the term is malignant program.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what that means, but it doesn't sound great. You know, I've also heard this term before. So, you know, don't get caught up in the whole competitiveness of a program, because that's not necessarily an indicator of whether it's going to be good.
Yeah,
for you.
The interview is a two-way street. I mean, it's not just the program checking out the student. The student should be checking out the program, too, and trying to figure out, is this going to be a good fit for me? Am I going to be happy spending the next, 3 to 7 years in this program? Because what nobody wants is for you to get a match, which you then are locked into, and then, you know, you're scrambling after a year or two to try and get out of that and find something else to do.
We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
So, Damien, give us the numbers. Give us the numbers as they relate to the match. Just throw out some numbers.
All right, here's what I'll do. I'll start
4.
I'll start on the national 42, I think is what you meant. We'll start on the national level, and then we'll take a look at our own class here. So this year, and again, like I mentioned before, this is heavily weighted towards the U.S. allopathic medical graduates. We had 18,000 roughly what we call active applicants. So that's what the NRMP refers to, the folks that have actually, you know, logged in to NRMP, submitted a rank order list. So we had about 18,000 of those. So just to give you an idea, last year there were 17,370-something students. So out of that 18,025, 16,900-some were matched. And again, to the NRMP, as long as you've got a first-year position, they consider you matched. So that left, unfortunately, almost 1,100 students who had no match at that point. And just to get an idea of the overall picture, I think Dave was giving some overall numbers before, but how it breaks out is there are the 18,000 some active applicants in from allopathic medical schools. There were 1,500 some from these were previous graduates, so graduates that have gone on, done something for the past year, and then re-entered the match. Osteopaths, there were almost 3,000. There were U.S. citizen students, but they graduated from international medical schools. There were about 5,000 of those. Then non-U.S. citizen graduates of international medical schools, there were about 7,400 of those. So total applicants we're looking at, again, active applicants, we're talking about 35,000 some overall. So
This is the point where everybody realizes that those numbers I just completely made up.
Well, no, I mean, you were in the ballpark.
Kind of. 50 billion people.
We're not quite at 50 billion yet. All so right. That's the good news. And the issues, of course, are that, you know, from year to year, you've got, sort of ebb and flow from different specialties. Some specialties are considered, much more competitive than others just because of the number of students that want to go into that, whatever those fields happen to be, versus the number of residency spots that are actually available for those students. So, you know, the ones you always hear about, dermatology, orthopedic surgery, those sorts of things. And the number of positions nationally hasn't gone up for a number of years, but due to physician shortages that will be coming up here, there's been a huge push to increase class sizes at allopathic medical schools, as well as bring new schools online. And so we're starting to see more and more allopathic medical schools going into the match as those class sizes hit and the new schools start graduating their students. And so that's the big fear right now, is competitiveness just overall for the match is going to go up because those residency spots aren't going to have a requisite increase. And then locally, we actually saw a big boost in the number of students that went into primary care fields. So, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
What did you, what was your match again?
I matched in family medicine at the Lawrence Family Medicine Residency in Massachusetts.
I'm from Massachusetts.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Ah, I was born in Worcester.
You guys are like neighbors. So we had almost half the class go into a primary care field. Wow. And how we define that is family medicine, internal medicine, OB-GYN, and PEDS, so pediatrics. So those are what we consider primary care fields. And so, yeah, almost half our class went into primary care, which is, of course, an emphasis for our school. So we were very happy to see that. Just to give you an idea, last year we had 40% of our class. Oh, and this is a slightly bigger class size this year, too. So we were very happy to see that. We had, about 32% will be doing at least a year of postgraduate training in Iowa. So they're going to remain in Iowa. And then of that group, 33 of those students will actually be doing at least a year at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics here. So we're always happy to see our folks stick around. And, you know, which specialties those are that end up staying at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, again, kind of ebbs and flows from year to year. So it's not always the same specialties that we see a lot of those students going into. And then geographically, the number one state outside of Iowa is Wisconsin. We're sending 12 students there. 11 students will go to California, always a big state for us. And then third comes Illinois. And there's always some fluctuation there, but Wisconsin, California, Missouri, Illinois, Minnesota, you know, our sort of Midwest states tend to dominate those.
Melissa, did you get a lot of coaching on how to do interviews?
So I did a lot of, I felt like when I was going on my interviews, I kind of used my personal statement writing to kind of guide what I wanted to say, because family medicine interviews are a little bit different from interviews in other specialties. Family medicine interviews are really about getting to know you as a person and whether or not you're a fit for kind of the culture of that program. So a lot of times people just came out and said, tell me about yourself, or tell me how you came to medicine. And kind of throughout the whole process, it was funny how my answers changed from the beginning of the interview season till the end, because I was able to like further refine my personal narrative in a way that I felt kind of represented why I wanted to do family medicine and primary care.
Did you do a lot of handshaking on the interview trail by the chance?
I did handshaking, but I did not practice handshaking.
Well, why did you shake hands? Why do people shake hands?
Are you talking about from like a disease controls perspective?
I'm talking, what's the purpose of handshaking?
It's a customary greeting.
Yeah, you're wrong. a public research university in Israel says it's because you and the other party wanted a chance to smell each other. Handshaking may give people, according to them, handshaking may give people the opportunity to smell each other in a socially acceptable way. People often sniff their own hands. They just do this. I mean, people smell their hands.
Everyone right now is sniffing their own hand.
And they do so for a much longer time after shaking someone else's hand. The number of seconds doubled after an experimenter greeted them with a handshake.
See, but I feel like this is different in like medical fields, because you're trained, as soon as you touch another person, you immediately sanitize your hands. And then that would completely negate the factor that you're going to smell another scent.
But I think in an interview setting, you're not going to be like, here, okay.
Where's the hand sanitizer?
So then they were curious, does a handshake really transfer body odors? And they experimentally decided that it does. They wore rubber gloves and they were able to find smell residues.
Doesn't that depend on the other person's hand?
Apparently.
Have they washed their hand recently? What were they doing? Like, were they just cooking? Or, I mean, wouldn't that depend on what the other person's hand was up to?
I don't think they were cooking just before the interview.
I'm just saying, I mean...
Maybe a microwave meal, I don't know.
We're talking about transferring odors.
280 volunteers were filmed by hidden camera before and after being greeted by experimenters who either used a handshake or didn't. They also somehow, I'm hoping non-awkwardly, measured nasal airflow... to make sure that they were actually sniffing their hands and not just raising them up to their face. And if experimenters wore a unisex perfume on their hands, hand sniffing increased. But if odors were derived from sex hormones were used, sniffing decreased, proving hand sniffing was olfactory behavior. So, yeah. I hope you all get a good smell.
Well, I just have a terrible sense of smell anyway, so apparently I'm the outlier in this case.
So you just leaned in real close on all of your interviews.
Yeah, they're like, excuse me, residency director.
I was thinking this was a way to like bring people in close so you could smell them like casually or something. I wasn't picturing someone stopping and smelling their hand afterwards.
Actually smelling their hand. So
what can you tell about a person from their hand scent?
I don't know.
That's the question.
I don't know.
What is unisex perfume?
Patchouli. I really don't know. There's so many questions. Most research, good research, so may create more questions than it answers. I'm not really sure if that's totally the idea.
So this must be great research, then.
Yeah. I also wanted to give you a bit of advice before you actually head out and become a quote-unquote real doctor, Melissa. And that is that a study out of Harvard this week says that patients may be full of crap. not intentionally, of course, but still. Specifically, a longitudinal study of over older Americans were matched with their Medicare claims. And then when asked if they'd had a heart attack in the last 2 years, only a third of respondents who claimed that they'd had an acute MI actually had one, according to their Medicare claims. Another 41% did have some sort of heart-related condition, but not a heart attack. A quarter said they'd had a heart attack in the past 2 years, but hadn't even had an inpatient admission in the last 2.5 years. And a third of people whose Medicare claims showed they had a heart attack didn't report having one. when interviewed. So
interesting.
Put all those history taking skills to work because they don't mean a thing. At least not when it comes to having a heart attack.
So this is why we're all counting on the Apple Watch. Is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. For absolutely yes,
pure accuracy.
Your encapsulated medical record, like implanted beneath under your skin.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting though is that those who said they'd had a heart attack that wasn't backed up by their Medicare claims history were twice as likely to die in the next year as the average Medicare patient.
Wow.
So...
of a heart attack?
Just to die. So, I guess maybe the history does have some use. It's just not what you thought it was. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of odd. And then some advice for when the time comes to take your boards.
More boards.
Boards forever.
Only one left.
Well, for many years, after docs had finished their training, primary care docs took one test called the board exams from the American Board of Internal Medicine. Specialists took some additional exams, but pretty much that was it for the sort of high stakes, you know, exams. Education continued in the form of continuing med ed credit, which docs had to get a certain amount to stay certified. Mm-hmm. But that the American Board of Internal Medicine has insisted on additional exams every 10 years for a lot of specialties. And now there's a war going on.
A civil war going on.
Because a lot of physicians feel that it costs them thousands of money and does nothing, mm-hmm. right? So apparently time away from their patients and their practice, not to mention their families, all this extra time studying. And then the boards seem to include additional questions from outside one specialty, like peds anesthesiologists being asked about adult anesthesia or internists being asked questions from subspecialties that they'd normally just call a consult on. Passing rates have been dropping. From 2010, 88% pass rate for internists. 2014 went down to 80%. And then the ABIM is just like, we'll retake the test. It'll only cost you thousands of dollars and more time away from your patients. And also, it's worth pointing out that according to the article I read, the ABIM is rolling in dough. 2013, $55 million in revenue, up from $16 million in 2001. The top officers were paid a lot of money, $400,000 to $800,000. So yeah, there's a revolt. Fed up docs have now created the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons that offers lower fees, fewer certification exams, a volunteer board made up of top names in medicine. And so, you know, you can pick and choose which board exam you go with in the future.
I feel like a lot of the, you know, controversy over board certifications and a lot of other, you know, changes in medicine is the fact that the reason why most people go into medicine is for the patients.
Yeah.
And when you're taking physicians' time away from being able to perform patient care, it's something that really, really bothers them. By having, you know, exams that are maybe not relevant or exams that remind you of when you were in medical school, you know, studying at all hours of the night, but at the same time having the added responsibility of taking care of actual patients, it frustrates a lot of people, and it makes them, you know, trying to find other ways of, you know, still fulfilling the same goal of having continuing medical education throughout the course of a physician's lifetime, because medicine is always changing.
Yeah.
But having it constructed in a way that actually benefits patients rather than benefiting the board's pocketbooks.
I always thought that these board exams were somehow mandated by law in some way, but really originally they were just like, you know, we feel as physicians, we feel like we should, you know, recertify it or, you know, we should take these board exams and then, you know, be on the lookout for ourselves to continue our education to because it's a professional responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised. I thought it was just, you know, it's like by law you have to take an exam, but that's not the case.
We need to pass all steps. So step one, step two, step three, in order to obtain a medical license. So in order to practice medicine based on which state you're in.
Right.
But beyond that,
there's these additional exams that some people have to take. Do all
primary?
Those are just to maintain your board certification.
Right, I think. Maintain and your certification. Right.
So that's not necessarily required, but just a lot of, like, most places are going to require
that
you
don't
have
take it, yeah, you're...
It's
more of a de facto requirement.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's, yeah.
Well, there you go.
I just think it'll be tough to adopt this new standard because you have to have the employers willing to accept that certification instead of the standard... Whatever the AE, whatever the old one is.
I guess what's interesting though is that I mean, if enough MDs are annoyed at the onerous requirements, then you can probably assume that that number will include people who make the hiring decisions and things like that. But it would be interesting to see how that plays out.
But until that transition happens, you're going to have to certify in both, which is even more work.
You think?
Well, I mean, if you're not just going to drop one, or else you'll be unemployable in the meantime until this transition occurs. I don't know. It just seems like a logistical challenge.
I don't like the sound of that.
Yeah.
I don't like the sound of doing much work.
The most anyway, abrasive two words in the English language today.
Yeah. Well, look, we're about out of time. I want to thank you guys for joining us, especially you, Melissa.
Yay,
congratulations.
Yeah, congrats.
amazing work. Yeah, good luck out there.
Good luck to all of you, too.
All right. If you liked what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to talk to us about your match, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox. And our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.